Today is Friday. It's July 15th, 2022. This is part four of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Gary Ladd, last name spelled L-A-D-D. My name is Tom Martin. We are in the kitchen of Gary's house here in beautiful Page, Arizona. And Gary, thank you so much for having us at the house here to do this.
You're welcome.
We left off when you had just arrived at Kitt Peak Observatory. Can you kind of go over again how it was that you got there? When did you arrive, and what was your housing like? What were your thoughts of the place when you first showed up?
Okay, well, it was just happenstance that I ended up getting a job at Kitt Peak, but it started back in 1968 when I accompanied a friend of mine who I had not known very long, but I had just moved from Cleveland, Ohio area back to St. Louis after having been away for 2 or 3 years. His name was Bill Shaning, and I met him through caving. Shaning is spelled S-C-H-O-E-N-I-N-G, Bill Shaning. And Bill had gone to the same college that I did, Central Methodist College in Missouri, and had gotten a job at Kitt Peak working, and actually I think the head of their photographic research division. He was about to drive from St. Louis to Tucson and said, hey, if you want to come along, you're welcome, and then fly home. But it's going to take maybe 3 days to get out there. And so it sounded good. I still had my senior year in college, and I went along with him. And it was the first time I had been in southern Arizona. And I thought it was dynamite. It was incredibly beautiful. And we went up to the observatory, and I thought that place was terrific, up at 7,000 feet and covered with telescope buildings and support buildings. And I decided very quickly, boy, this would be a great place to work. So I still had a year of college left. So I went back to Missouri and finished college and ended up working not at Kitt Peak initially, but in a photography shop in St. Louis, and did that for just a short while. And then Bill mentioned that he had gone on this incredible dory trip down Grand Canyon in 69. The first time he was on the trip was the next summer after he moved out to Tucson. And he met Francois Lede, and Martin Litton was on that trip. And when Bill described this trip, and when I later saw the photographs, I decided that was something I wanted to do too. And I think it was a 19-day trip. Martin was not officially a commercial outfitter at the time, but he did charge people to go on the trip, of course, and it was $800, I think, which was most of my life savings at the time. But I did go on that trip, and that kind of changed the course of my life. I did apply for a job at Kitt Peak, but did not get it. It was given to someone else, so I had to wait for another opening. Meanwhile, I went on a long trip around the West, which I think I may have already described, and then went home and worked at Goodyear Tire and Rubber in a warehouse, which paid much better than the $1.65 I was getting at Fox Photo. But that was not much fun and not really what I wanted to do. And I kept waiting for this job at Kitt Peak to show up, and it did not, and it did not for months and months. And so I had gone back to school at Washington University in St. Louis studying architecture. And the end of the semester came, and still I had not heard from the observatory. So I waited until the last day that I could still sign up for a second semester. And of course, that evening I got a call from Kitt Peak and initially told them, no, I've already decided I'm going to become an architect. I'm sorry. But then I didn't sleep well that night and got up in the morning and called Art Hoag, who, Art's name is Arthur, H-O-A-G. And he was an astronomer at Kitt Peak and the head of the Stellar Division, and eventually became the director of Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff. But I talked with Art, and he wondered why I said no, and then the next morning, yes, but I didn't have an explanation other than I wanted to come out, and I thought it was a mistake to say no. So I did get to the job, and in late February, another friend of mine from the St. Louis area and I drove out to Grand Canyon and did a day hike down to Phantom Ranch and back out right at the end of February, and then drove to Tucson. Will, my friend, eventually also worked at Kitt Peak for a short time, but I started the 1st of March, 1972. That was the 100th anniversary of the first national park, of course. Yellowstone became a national park in 1872 on that date, which that happenstance did not escape me. But at first I was assigned to do night assistant duty. And night assistant has many different definitions in astronomy. Usually it just means in some way you're a helper for an astronomer during the night. But in my case, the way Kitt Peak had it set up, there were three of us assigned to help with instrument changes during the day so that we learned where the plugs went and where the different slides were located for putting in filters, and also got to know the telescopes, and there were quite a few different telescopes on Kitt Peak at that time. A 150-inch telescope, what's now called the 4-meter telescope, was under construction but was nearly done. There was an 84-inch, two 36-inch telescopes, two 16-inch telescopes, a 50-inch, and I'm probably forgetting something, but also the University of Arizona had a 90-inch telescope. And the solar telescope also, very special telescope, was located there. So my job was to help with instrument changes during the day. And at night, when I was assigned to, I would stay up until 2 o'clock. And if a call came from an astronomer working who was having some kind of problem, and it might be that the dome stopped turning, or the reticle light had burned out, or the toilet was overflowing, or there was a scorpion in the developing tray, no matter what it was, the night assistants would try to help them out.
Gary, I've got just a bunch of questions for you here. You mentioned the 150-inch under construction. Was it being built elsewhere and was going to be brought to the mountain, or was it being built on the mountain?
The building, of course, was being built there, and it was a very tall, very impressive, imposing building. But the mirror, I believe, came from the photo from the mirror lab at Kitt Peak. So the observatory had its own mirror polishing facilities.
Wow.
The more I think about that, the more sure I'm that's true. So
it was made in this building and then moved across the street to the observatory kind of thing?
It was made, I'm not being clear about this. There's a big office building in Tucson, where astronomers work, where the computers are located, where there's an instrument shop, because all of these instruments that go on telescopes are specially made for the telescopes that exist on the mountain. So there were a lot of facilities there and a lot of people working there. And it was right across the street from Stewart Observatory, the University of Arizona observatory offices. But once the mirror was completed, or anything that was made in the Kitt Peak shops, they had to be taken up to the mountain.
Oh, so the Kitt Peak shops weren't on Kitt Peak, they were in Tucson.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So that was brought up, the mountain, 150 inches is 12, 13, 14 foot diameter?
Yeah, 13 or 14
that's
feet.
That's a semi-truck right there, and it's got to be super heavy, this thing. And you don't want to hit a bump too fast.
Yeah, it's a delicate business, and everybody's relieved once the mirror is not only taken up to the mountain, but loaded into the telescope, which is over 100 feet above the ground floor where the mirror first enters the building.
So that's a large crane that can lift a lot of weight?
Yes, and I never saw that kind of work done, but it had to be repeated every once in a while because the mirror gradually degrades. It's covered in a very thin film of aluminum, and that surface, because it's exposed to the elements during the work that's being done, gradually gets dirty. It can be washed a couple of times, but eventually it has to be replaced. So one of the operations that also makes people nervous is the mirror is taken out of the telescope and lowered down to the ground floor to an aluminization chamber.
Wow.
Where it's cleaned and then a new layer of aluminum is put on. And that happens every 2 or 3 or 4 years.
Right there in the bottom of the observatory.
Yes, yeah.
Wow. Okay.
It's a big vacuum chamber where aluminum is evaporated and is captured on the mirror surface.
Wow. Okay. The 1st of March, I'm assuming at 7,000 feet, you might have seen some snow up there maybe?
I don't remember what it was like when I first got up there, but yeah, sure.
Okay. And were your living quarters there, or did you commute from Tucson every day?
For the first 9 months that I worked there, I lived on the mountain.
Okay.
And really, it's a dormitory room. It was a room, room number 12, in the original first stellar dormitory. And it was kind of like a motel. I walked down a hallway and turned to room number 12, and it was a bathroom and a bedroom. But I was off on weekends, and part of the time I would just stay on the mountain, go hiking on the mountain, go west and go into a national park or monument, Oregon Pipe, yes, thank you. Or I also kind of kept a room at Bill Shaning's house. So Bill and another guy that worked at Kitt Peak, Tom Zinner, all of us were involved in those Grand Canyon River trips, early trips, kind of lived at Bill's house, and then some of us went to the mountain fairly frequently.
How do you spell Tom's last name?
Last name is Zinter, Z-I-N-T-E-R.
Okay, thank you. And then do you remember what your pay was? Was that per week or how did that, per hour? How did that work?
Yeah, in fact, I've been thinking about this recently because of the rate of inflation recently. I think I started at $6,700 a year. I remember that there was a $300 increase in my salary after the first few months, and I think that took me to 7,000.
Okay.
I think there's been an eightfold increase in the cost of living since then.
But did they charge you for your room and board?
No.
Okay. So housing provided, food provided? Was there a dining room there, three meals a day?
Yep, four meals a day, actually, because there's a midnight lunch for astronomers who are up all night, including those who are working in the winter when the nights are 12 hours long. So
that makes sense.
And you could drive down or walk down from your telescope dome and go to the kitchen to have dinner, or you could call for one to be prepared and bring it up in a paper bag.
Oh, and brought to you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It sounded like some of the work you did was during the day.
Yes.
So were you working, I mean, this is a flat fee. We're giving you $7,000 a year, but it sounds like they might have had you working 12-hour days, 5 days a week,
or more.
Or did it work out pretty well?
Well, because I was just one of three people that were doing this kind of work, there were either two or three different shifts. So I might start at 8 o'clock in the morning and finish at 5.
Okay.
I might start at 2 in the afternoon and finish at 10, or I think start at 6 and finish at 2 in the morning.
Okay.
So we shared those duties, and the idea was that we would all learn the instruments and the telescopes and how they worked, and what we could do to fix things, so that no matter who was on in the middle of the night, they either could take care of the problem themselves, or they might be able to figure out who to call in Tucson who might know better how to keep from wasting valuable telescope time.
Were there people in Tucson on call and 24 hours a day all night long?
Not necessarily, and I don't remember exactly how that worked.
Okay. Or you just call Smith at home at 2 in the morning and wake him up and get him to tell you how to do this.
I don't remember doing that, so that may have been uncommon.
Can you tell me one or two of the more interesting repairs that you had on the mountain?
Interesting?
Repairs.
Boy, I don't think of any of the repairs being very interesting. The only one that comes to mind immediately is different domes have different ways of opening a shutter. Some of them, the shutters just rise up from the low end and go up and over the top and back down the other side.
Oh, wow. Okay. Just like following the arc of the dome.
Right.
Okay.
Yes. But that was, if it were that simple, it wouldn't be totally satisfactory, because the dome wouldn't be entirely out, or the shutter wouldn't be entirely out of the way if you were looking straight up. So there had to be some other way to open up more space for the telescope to look out of. And that often...
Do you want to get that?
Yeah.
It'll just sit there. We'll cut that out.
Okay. This is Gary Ladd. I should have known better.
It was easy. So we were talking about repairs.
Yeah, so another design for a shutter is that the lowestmost part of the shutter actually is on a hinge and is lowered out into the night. That part of the shutter might not be real long, but something happened on the lowering mechanism. So I and one of the other night assistants went up into the dome at the end of the night, because this was not a critical failure, to find out if we could figure out what had stopped it from working. And it was stuck in the up position, but not in the entirely up position. So the lower dome could not, I'm sorry, the upper dome could not be lowered down to this level, because the lower dome was out of, or the lower shutter was out of position a little bit.
So is this like the lower part leans out and the upper part goes up in a way on the arc of the dome.
Right.
So there's two halves to this thing.
Right.
Okay. And the upper part went away, but the lower part wouldn't open?
The lower part, I don't remember exactly how they got into this position, the astronomers, but the lower part would not fully go into its stowed position.
Oh, so it wouldn't... Stowed meaning closed?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, so it wouldn't close, in other words.
Right, huh? Yeah. Which meant that the upper part could not be brought down and meet with the lower part, because the lower part was out of position.
Okay.
Anyway, Will, my friend, and I went up there in the morning and got up in a precarious position and saw that the cable was tangled that would normally allow this to open up and then shut down again. And I was up there fooling around when suddenly that lower shutter opened up with me hanging on to it. But having pretty good sense at even that time, I let go of it, but Will grabbed me by the legs just in case I was about to go out the opening. Anyway, that wasn't a big deal. It's just what I remember right now.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I don't remember really being in any interesting situations regarding repairs.
But it sounds like you did a lot of things from, as you mentioned, plumbing, water backups, scorpions, just odds and ends of whatever needed to be done.
Yes, just whatever needed to be done in order to try to help the astronomer not waste their time.
Okay.
Because supporting a facility like this is very expensive. And, you know, if you lose an hour of observing time for some stupid idea, it's very painful. Especially if it's someone who's come from across the country and they only have an observing run that's only two nights or three nights long, and you give up part of it, not because there are clouds in the way, which you can't have any control over, but because some electronics part has burned up and needs to be replaced.
Did you have a fairly large supply of spare parts up there?
We did, yeah.
Okay.
I think that was our main way to fix things, is whatever's going bad, take it out and put in a new one.
Okay. And did you meet some interesting astronomers?
I saw Chip Arp, I think, one time, and he was a famous astronomer from California. I think he was involved in trying to figure out the spectra of quasars. When the first quasars were seen, nobody knew what the heck these things were, because I'm probably not going to get part of this right, but they were stellar-like. They looked like stars, but they were way too bright for stars, and they were very distant. And the problem was is that they were so distant that the spectra were offset to the red, red end of the spectrum, red-shifted, that no one recognized the pattern of the lines. Huh. They were so far away. And I think he may have been the one that finally figured out what they were.
Okay.
Anyway, I didn't talk with him or work with him, but I think I saw him there. And there was a very old guy by the name of Van Beesbrock that I worked with. Tom, you're asking me to spell something that I've never known how to spell.
V-A-N.
V-A-N.
B-E-S.
B-I-E-S. B-R-O-E-C-K or something like that.
Okay, close enough.
Van Beesbrock. And he was an expert. He was known the world over, I think, for having exceedingly good eyesight. Now, normally, that's not important in astronomy. But he gained his fame and was very good at his job at being able to measure angular distances to binary stars. So his sight was exceedingly good. And today, you know, that would not be a problem. But back as far as, you know, this was in 1972, 73, and he was probably 80 years old at that time. So when he was younger, having good eyesight was really important, because I don't think the photographic plates were all that good at the time yet. Okay. And anyway, I worked with him on the 84-inch telescope. And, he was interesting and a nice guy.
Tell me a little bit more about him.
I don't think I know more about him.
Okay.
He was a little short, tiny guy, very quiet and hard at work at the telescope. We didn't waste any time. I do have one other story I would like to tell you that the Van Beesbrock story reminds me of. Most of the nights when I worked on the telescope were really pretty boring. You know, things have changed now somewhat, but at that time, 50 years ago, most of the telescope domes had no separate room where you were spending your time when you were at work on the telescope. Today, larger telescopes have insulated separate rooms with windows that look out at the telescope to make sure that they're doing okay. But at the time that I was there, when I was a night assistant, this isn't the other definition of night assistant on Kitt Peak. You are actually helping an astronomer. You are their assistant. And most observatories had night assistant programs because things come up and it helps save time if there are two of you and not just one of you, especially if one of you is more knowledgeable about these particular facilities. So I was working with Helmut Abt, A-B-T. Helmut was a really interesting guy, which I didn't even fully understand until rather recently, which I'll go into in a minute. But Helmut was a spectroscopist. He was more interested in helping other astronomers do their work than doing his own, perhaps. Now, I'm not sure I'm quite right in saying exactly that, but for years and years and years, he was the editor of the APJ, the Astrophysical Journal, and he knew what other people were working on, and at least in part because of his work as the editor, he realized that there were certain projects that nobody would get around to because it really wasn't very glorious. It wasn't really something that would make them famous. It would just be a new catalog that would list binary stars all the way down to magnitude such and such, something like that. And he wrote a lot of really interesting papers on the lives of astronomers. Like when he wrote one paper, he discovered that the average astronomer lives 8 years longer than the average American, which he couldn't account for that, except that they get to spend really lovely nights outside looking at the sky.
How cool is that?
But most of the work he did, most of the papers he wrote were helpful to other astronomers doing their work, catalogs especially. But he did have projects on his own, and when I was helping him, he was on working on what was called the Coudé feed. So the 84-inch telescope, after I had started working at Kitt Peak, under the direction, I believe, mostly of Art Hoag, my boss, had put in a separate mirror system that would take advantage of a Coudé spectroscopy room. Now, in the original 84-inch building, there was a large room that was devoted to doing high dispersion spectroscopy. You can't do that unless you've got a lot of space. But you don't have a lot of space if the instruments hanging on the telescope. Through a strange arrangement of mirrors, you could get the light beam to go out an axis of the movement of the telescope and eventually end up being parallel to the celestial pole, or the actually not the celestial pole, turn axis of the Earth. The light beam would, no matter where the telescope would point, was pointed, the beam of light coming from the mirror would eventually end up going south at an angle of your latitude into this room. So this was very good for certain kinds of work. Helmut, at least on this particular night, was interested in taking spectra, high dispersion spectra, of a long list of, I think it was over 100 stars, maybe 110 wow. stars. In order to do this work, there are several different rooms involved. Number one, there's a desk where I sat and wrote down information as fast as I could. The name of the star, the number of the star, the RA of the star, the position of the star, how far above the horizon it was located, the condition of the sky.
And Helmut would be sort of talking to you on the phone or just shouting to you these numbers?
Helmut was in the same room.
Okay.
Part of the time. Both of us would move to other rooms momentarily, but Helmut would say, starting, and open a dark slide. That would allow the beam to go through a tiny slit and into the high dispersion spectrograph. And the exposures were short. Most exposures are not this short, but they might only be 1, 2, 3 minutes long. Then he would say, closing, and I'd hear the dark slide close. I would immediately write down the end time and then run up the steps and run up another set of steps up onto the platform underneath the telescope and start resetting the position of the telescope to the next star on the list he had provided.
Okay.
The star is really bright. He was doing bright stars. Meanwhile...
And he would give you a pre-assigned list of
yes.
where he wanted you to point the thing.
Yes, and okay. he had these arranged so that it was the most efficient
way to get through the sky.
That's right. That path was the most efficient. You weren't going all over the sky trying to find something. Meanwhile, I'm out there. I'm in the dome, moving the telescope. He has gone down another set of steps into the coude room. And that room we attempt to keep really clean because dust can have a bad effect on this high dispersion spectroscopy. So he's wearing booties and he steps on a sticky mat before he goes into the room, goes down some more steps, and I'm not sure what condition the lights are in that room, but he goes over to a little plate, and the plate was like 1 inch by 6 inches long. A little tiny thing, but it was where the spectra would be recorded.
Okay.
Reset the plate. And
so that's like a negative? A film, a light sensitive
yes.
negative?
It's just rather than being on a plastic film, it's on something more solid.
Huh.
And it's a photographic plate, but it reacts to specific wavelengths that astronomers are interested in.
And he would have to do this in the dark?
I think he did, but that is a little hard for me. I'm having trouble remembering it, and I'm not even sure I ever knew it because
okay.
I never entered the room at this time of day
okay.
when the work was being done. But there might have been ways to cheat.
Or a red light or something.
Yes, yeah. Okay, so he resets the plate, runs back up the stairs, goes to the eyepiece, and he is looking at a polished surface where the slit is for the spectrograph. As soon as he sees a bright star enter the field, because it's so bright, because that's all he has on his list, he is sure that this is the right object. He's got a control unit in his hand, which we called hand paddles, and begins to center up that star directly on the center of the slit. Now the slit's still closed, the dark slide is closed. As soon as he starts clicking those buttons, I hear the relays, and I turn off the lights in the dome, run down the steps, sit down at the desk, and he says, starting, and I write down the starting time. And then during the exposure, I'm writing down all of these other factors. And we did that all night during the winter, and I think we did 100, or maybe it's 110, which was a record or a near record. Anyway, it was not a boring night. It was an incredible experience. Wow. To just never stop. And we got a whole lot done that night. And that's the only time that I worked with Helmut. But I was aware that Helmut had become interested in archaeology, and he was doing work up here at Glen Canyon.
Oh, wow.
He and a guy by the name of Bill Miller, who was the head of the photographic lab at Palomar Observatories, somehow were both doing work up here, and they are the first ones, or among the first ones, to have discovered the Anasazi recording of the Crab Nebula explosion. Are you familiar with that story? And no? there were petroglyphs that turned out to have been in several locations over the Southwest that looked somewhat the same. A star-shaped object near a crescent-shaped object. And somebody, I'm not sure that was Helmut or Bill, figured out that it was a recording of the explosion, the supernova explosion of the Crab Nebula in 1054. And Bill and Helmut found one, I think, in Navajo Canyon or up on White Mesa. And I think Bill found another in the other, whichever other location of the two. And other people found more of these. And the timing of those petroglyphs was pretty much the timing of the Crab Nebula explosion. And there is a famous place in Chaco Canyon where you can crawl in behind some boulders that have fallen, and on us, okay, I'm sorry, I'm telling you something about some other astronomical event. But anyway, there are several of these recordings, and the funny thing is that nobody recorded it in Europe, but this was a star so bright that it could be seen in the daylight.
Oh, wow.
The Chinese recorded it.
Okay.
So their records match what we found here. But the Europeans, for reasons that we may not understand, other than the general feeling was at that time, the sky is perfect. And then when a flaw develops like this, they ignore it.
Unless it was cloudy.
Just lasts for days.
Oh, okay. You know? Never mind. Huh.
Anyway, huh. Bill and Helmut were involved in that discovery.
When were they up here in Glen Canyon looking for those rock art? Was that in the 70s?
It would have been the 60s mostly, but maybe as late as the 70s. Yeah.
Okay.
And Helmut, a couple of years ago, wrote a book about his life, and he just retired, and he is 97, I think.
Wow.
You know?
Huh.
And he has done a lot of interesting things, and has been all over the world. He's been everywhere. Never married, just explored the world. And oh, and then the other thing I'm really, I shouldn't forget this. I've forgotten how this came about, but he was the initial person that looked for a site for the National Observatory. And it started out by Helmut renting a plane and a pilot, Cessna 172 or 182 or something, and flying around the Southwest looking at mountaintops.
Okay.
Now, he had a list that he started with to begin with, but certain mountains are obviously not good. There's just not enough space on the top. They're too much of a peak. Others lie too close to other mountains from which the air mass usually moves, and that screws up the seeing, makes it the moving air mass more turbulent. So those places are eliminated. The idea that it needed to be in the Southwest, where the skies are generally clear, was valid, of course, but it also needed to be pretty near a pretty big, but not too big, city, especially if it had a university. You can't have these things out in the middle of nowhere, at least in the 1950s you couldn't. So he made the original assessment, and then he and others went on muleback and horseback and put small telescopes up on some of these peaks just to check the quality of the seeing.
Wow.
And eventually, by elimination, they carved the list down to Kitt Peak. So he was involved in every step of that, and even deciding what should go on the mountain and what kind of telescopes. And anyway, that was a really interesting night with a really interesting fellow, although we never spoke.
He just worked. I wonder, just kind of diverging for just a second, as a site chosen in the 1960s, today, 60 years later, the light pollution from the growth of Tucson spilling into the Avra Valley, halfway between Tucson and Kitt Peak, I wonder how effective that observatory is now, given the adjacent light encroachment.
It's really hurt it, but on the other hand, the money in astronomy is not coming to the desert Southwest anymore. There are better sites. So if you've got plans for an important telescope, you will go to Hawaii or Chile.
Okay.
Yeah. So
Chile, I think of the Atacama Desert.
Yes.
Very dry, very high.
Yep.
Not a lot of people there.
Yep.
Okay.
And all of those factors are important. Infrared astronomy is difficult in really wet conditions. So high and dry and empty.
Or like the James Webb, you go out outer space.
Yeah, that's the other half of it. Even though there is money for really big telescopes on Earth, because the James Webb, no matter how terrific it is, it can't do enough. There are too many projects.
Okay.
So it's being saved for projects that cannot be done on Earth.
On the ground.
Yeah.
Okay.
But there's still money for big telescopes, but they're going to be built in Hawaii or in Chile.
I had another question. As a young photographer, you became certainly well-known throughout the United States, maybe around the world, for a picture that you took of a lightning storm on the top of Kitt Peak. Can you talk about how that all came about?
Yeah. That was made shortly after I started working at Kitt Peak, and it was on my weekend, but I was staying on the mountain that weekend. And it was just over 50 years ago, actually, 4th of June, 1972. And I hadn't been there very long. I didn't know what the weather was like every part of the year, every season. And this big storm developed like a monsoon storm, but it was the 4th of June, and I was free to try to take pictures of it. I had attempted taking pictures of lightning before, but not very much, and never with any real success.
So to take pictures of lightning, today there's a gizmo Yeah. It works on your shutter, and it senses the lightning strike and fires the shutter.
Yeah.
Back in June of 1972, was this your first exposure to Arizona lightning storm monsoons?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay, and then you're thinking, okay, well, I'm going to wait until I see the flash and then push the button?
Oh, well, the way it was done then, the way I did it, was, okay, there's a big lightning storm coming up. I walked up from the dormitory room to the 84-inch telescope, and it has a public area where people can walk up a set of stairs and look at the telescope. That set of stairs has a landing and a 180-degree bend in it, and it has big windows facing south and north. That's where I went. Actually, that's not where I went. I went to the south side of the building and started taking pictures of this big storm off in the distance. So,
and you were inside with mirrors, or are you standing outside?
I'm outside at this point.
Okay, just a minute. Let me think about this for a minute. You're on a large metal building.
Yes.
And a lightning storm is approaching. Did this thought ever cross your mind?
I will explain that.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Okay, so when I went up there at first, the storm was distant. It was down near Baba Kiveri. But it kept moving closer and closer and closer, and I just kept staying out there. I'm guessing at the exposure. The camera's on a tripod. I'm doing time exposures. I open up the shutter, I wait until there's a flash or a couple of flashes, and I close the shutter, advance the film, and try it again. It's dark out, so it doesn't matter if the shutter is open when there's no light source other than the lightning. Of course, I didn't know what the exposure should be. I was guessing at that. I couldn't even frame the scene. I was guessing at that. I was guessing at the f-stop. I was guessing at everything, and that's why lightning photography at that time was really difficult. But I was aware that the storm was more or less right overhead, because I could see in reflections in the window of lightning bolts that were in the other direction. So, I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead. I went around to the other side. I did not go inside yet. I went around to the north side and started taking pictures that direction. And then there was a bolt that hit really close and scared the heck out of me. And I could not get inside the building fast enough. I remember going through the door when it was only open 3 inches wide. I got through that, that's right. And I went up the stairs, and there was another person there. And this was a visiting astronomer or astronomer student. And both of us, side by side, were taking pictures out of that north-facing window. And we're guessing. We're talking to one another about what we ought to be doing in order to capture this. And, of course, there were tremendous flashes, but you get dark adapted and the flash is so bright that you don't really know what you saw. You just saw a bolt, but what did it illuminate and how bright was it? And you're blinded by it. So I had high hopes, but I had no idea of what was on the film. At that time, I was sending my film off to Kodak to be processed, and after a week, it came back. It arrived at the office where we all had mailboxes at Kitt Peak, and I opened it up and sat down there in the office couch in a little lounge area, and just started holding these up to the light and was knocked off my chair. I mean, I had no idea. And I started showing it around to other people up there, but as soon as I went downtown, I took it to Art Hoag to see it. So he was my boss. And he looked at it and he said, "Oh man." And so we took it to the conference room where there was a slide projector and a big screen and projected it. And then I think I was there for an hour while people came in and looked at it.
So Art was just pulling people in saying, "You got to see this?"
He may have pulled somebody in, but once the word got out, it was just a continuous flow of the word being
This
passed.
Was at the Kitt Peak office?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then one of the guys who came in, John Lutnes, L-U-T-N-E-S, he was the head of the regular photographic lab at Kitt Peak that just took pictures for astronomers and did publication stuff. And John was an older guy, and he had done everything in photography and knew everybody. And he said, "Gary, I'm going to New York City on business in 3 weeks. You give me a copy of that and I'll put it on so-and-so's desk at Life Magazine." And I got him a copy. He took it to this guy's desk and it showed up in Life, and that was the first time I ever had a picture printed. Started out in Life, and it's been generally downhill ever since then.
Life was good to you.
Well, I got fooled, I feel, that I thought, wow, I'm really good at this, I can do this, and then something that spectacular never came close to happening again.
Well, I don't know, you've got some pretty spectacular landscapes.
Well, not like that Kitt Peak scene. That thing had universal appeal. It was published hundreds of times, and it helped me pay for the Tadahatsu and made up for the fact I wasn't making that much money at Kitt Peak for
nice.
Years.
Nice. So just to go over this again, you're assuming your focus is on infinity.
It was, yeah.
And you don't know how big the aperture should be. You're in control of the speed because you'd simply take the lens cap off and then put it back on again after there's a bolt or two.
You know, old, really old photographers used to do that, but I'm in control of the shutter. I can just press a button and keep it open, the bulb setting.
Got it.
So it's locked in the open position. Then something interesting happens, then I unlock it and it closes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Just kind of going over how you did that. On a tripod, so it was very stable.
Yes.
And that's that. Spectacular. Spectacular photo. We've been going about 52 minutes. Let's just want to ask you some more about your time at Kitt Peak. What else do you remember? You were there for how many years?
4.5, not counting that little stint of 1980.
Okay. And at one point you mentioned after 9 months you moved off the mountain.
Yes, and this is important because there was a fellow who provided a special camera that he was the only person at the observatory that knew how to take care of this thing. He was retiring, and Art Hoag thought I would be a good person to take over the work on that. It was called the Kron camera, K-R-O-N, and it was named after Jerry Kron, who lived in Flagstaff. He originally, I think, worked at Lick Observatory, and what he wanted was a camera that didn't use film but used electronographic plates. These were emulsions that reacted to being hit by electrons rather than photons of light.
Wow.
The grain size was tiny compared to photographic grains. That was the advantage.
Okay.
And that makes another advantage. The grain size is so small that the statistics that come out of measuring the brightness of different objects or different parts of an extended object are much more accurate. And are good for a much wider range of brightnesses. So it's kind of like comparing film that we were using at the telescope, or even film that we would use today, to digital photography today, which has a much wider dynamic range. It is able to, I actually probably don't remember the numbers, but let's say film had a dynamic range that was maybe good for 5 or 6 f-stops. That would cover everything from black to white, absolutely no exposure to total overexposure. But objects out there have a much wider range of brightnesses, which means that you're losing detail in the dark areas and you're losing detail in the bright areas. But electronographic cameras were able to capture, I'm kind of guessing here, let's say 10 or 12 f-stops in brightness. They were much closer to today's digital cameras. So they had a huge advantage, but they were very hard to take care of. There were different designs, and Jerry Krohn's design was very unique, and he designed it, and I think he may have actually done the machining on it to begin with. And it was a very large vacuum tube, about 10 inches long, a huge vacuum tube. It had a photocathode window at one end, and it had some strangely shaped metal objects on the interior that focused the light, the electrons that were knocked off the photocathode, to go through a little hole. And then most electronographic cameras had a phosphor screen behind that. But the phosphor screen was what you would put a photographic plate up against. It wasn't really, and what I'm doing something wrong here. I shouldn't have called this an electronographic camera. It was an image intensifier, which allowed you to take pictures a lot more quickly, but really did not give you an improvement in the statistics. It brightened up the light that was being recorded. But in the electronographic camera, of which the Krohn design was one, it went to a glass plate that was inside of the vacuum, which is completely bizarre, because you want to get to that plate to develop it. And glass plates covered with an emulsion are extremely dirty, and they outgas, and they will destroy the photocathode. So in order to keep that from happening, you had to cool it to liquid nitrogen temperatures.
Wow.
The thing was extremely cold, and the plates were only about 3 or 3.5 inches in diameter, and you could only take little tiny pictures on it, a centimeter or a little more on it. And there was a clever but often malfunctioning mechanism that allowed you to advance the plate by the use of magnets without having any direct connection into the vacuum tube. Now, some of the electronic cameras, you had to destroy the vacuum tube in order to extract the plate. You only got one use out of it.
Wow.
But this one had a really bizarre, really tricky, straight through, wide mouth valve that you could close, preserve the vacuum where the photocathode lived, change plates, put a new one on, cool it down to liquid nitrogen temperatures before you use it, and opened up the valve again. And
So you basically have access to this where you can control the vacuum. So you can seal off part of the unit, take out the plate, put in another plate, then get the plate into a vacuum, into the main vacuum.
Yep.
Wow. Better than destroying the whole glass unit, though.
Yeah.
Huh.
And there were certain kinds of work for which it was ideal. Most people hated it, most astronomers, because it had lots of little problems. The calibration of it, it required another person to take care of it at night. It couldn't be left on the telescope. It had to be taken off the telescope, carried downstairs, put into the back of a Jeep, carried to a clean room elsewhere on the mountain, carried into a clean room, put on a vacuum pumping station to extract the plate after you did certain things, and prepare the plate for another night.
Wow.
And then it would have to be taken back to the telescope again. It was very good, but it just was such a pain in the neck, and the valve was very easily damaged. And it was called the coin valve because there was a coin that rolled in a slot, and then you would lock it into place in order to seal off the vacuum. But when it was time to use the camera, you cool down the plate holder, turned off some jack screws. A metal plate was just flexible enough to back the pressure off of this coin, let it roll out to the side, lock it into place, and then do the observations. And it was very easy to be fooled when this coin was in position, because the only way you could move it was by tilting the camera.
To get the coin to roll over the...
Yeah.
Wow.
But it worked most of the time, but not all of the time. And then if you turned those jack screws down when it was only semi in position, that was the end of the...
Oops.
The coin and the end of the photocathode eventually. Anyway, I did that for 3.5 years. And,
wow.
Did you go to Tucson to get special training about how that worked?
I was in Tucson. All of the lab work is being done in the city of Tucson.
Okay. So you have to go to Tucson to change the plates?
No.
In this thing? No.
It was a clean room on Kitt Peak.
Okay.
But I did get special training by going to Flagstaff because Jerry Krohn at that time was at the Naval Observatory.
Okay.
He was the director there. And his... The name Krohn shows up occasionally because his wife, Catherine Krohn, was involved in a lot of nice city projects, I think.
Huh. Cool.
Catherine Krohn. And their son became an astronomer also. Anyway, this was ideal for me because... I got credit for those really long nights at the telescope. Somebody had to babysit it. The astronomer couldn't do all of this stuff. I mean, they're from Philadelphia, so they don't know anything about a Krohn camera, but they want to use one because they've got a project where it is useful.
Okay.
So we'd be at the telescope out in the cold, and I would have a dewar of liquid nitrogen and keep filling up a container that was hanging on the instrument to keep the plate cold.
Wow.
Do that all night.
And you'd be wearing like a bunch of parka jackets and hats and gloves and booties and...
Yep.
Wow. Okay. So let's go back to the first question then about you moving into Tucson.
When I got the job of working on the Krohn camera, most of the time I was working in Tucson at their offices.
Okay.
I was only on the mountain a quarter of the time, maybe.
Okay.
Using the instrument. When I lived in Tucson, I was living at Bill's house.
Okay.
At least to begin with. But then, let's see, in 76, I think, I got an apartment.
Okay. And, 76 was about the time you left Kitt Peak.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Because it became increasingly clear that the Krohn camera was going to be replaced by what was being called TV systems, which were much better than photographic plates.
Huh.
and it's certainly not a term we would have used then, but TV systems and astronomy were another name, as it turned out, for digital photography.
Okay.
Huh.
And
in 1976?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, astronomy got this from the military.
Okay.
Which was a common occurrence. You know, night vision goggles were related to what astronomers were doing. And so it became increasingly clear that the Kron camera would not last very much longer. And therefore, I lost kind of things that I would normally do. We had three cameras, I think, and they all required a lot of maintenance. And I was asked or told to help with other projects. And I hated these because it was like, okay, well, this week go help Dr. Kidman. And I didn't know what I was doing, you know. I have no idea what the guy is doing. I don't know anything about his instrument. And it was terrible. And I did not like that at all. Now, if I had been patient, eventually I would have been given a real solid project to work on. But at the moment, there just wasn't one. And I went on a really terrific San Juan River trip in the dories the summer of 76. And when I came back, I was kind of different, kind of thinking, boy, I don't know. And then we had the habit of playing volleyball at noon at Kitt Peak. There was a compound that the building kind of surrounded, and a bunch of us, especially from the electronics division, would get out there and play volleyball, and it was terrific. And then one day I fell, and it became really clear when I walked back to my office that, boy, I have really done something bad with my shoulder, and I had separated it, and I just decided right then, I'm leaving. I'm getting a message.
Okay. Maybe this would be a good time to put a comma in this interview series, because I would like to know more about that San Juan River trip.
I don't remember, actually, what was so good about it. I just know that I didn't really like being back in the laboratory after that trip.
I'm not surprised. And in 76, you met Eber Glendinning. G-L-E-N-D-I-N-I-N-G.
Yeah, I always had trouble with his name, but
Eber, E-B-E-R.
Yes.
Yeah. Is that right? Was that the year you met?
I believe so. Now,
okay.
I might have kind of met him because Jim Devaney knew him.
Okay.
And when we, in 75, which was our long 32-day river trip, we went to the South Rim, maybe before, but for sure after, because we had Kathy Green, who was a park ranger, who went with us. Now, I'm not sure that she was really the reason we were there, but we also had extra food taken down by mule, just in case we ran into trouble. So we would have dropped off that sack of food. But we ran into Eber Glendinning at the restaurant at the Yavapai, and Jim and Eber talked, but I didn't know him at the time. And at that time, he had this big beard. But in 76, I'm not sure how I knew about these, but I knew Eber was doing these. I left Kitt Peak and immediately decided I'm going to do a river trip on Lake Powell. And that is the 19-day trip that I did from Hite to Waweep rowing alone. I wanted to see this place. And I had never been out on it except for, I think, the Aramark two-hour tour.
Okay, so next time, let's start with that trip, that 19-day trip.
Okay.
And then I want to know more about Eber.
Okay.
Yeah. Is there anything else in the material we've just covered that you wanted to bring in?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, with that, then this will conclude a part four, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Gary Ladd. Today is Friday, July 15th, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Gary, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.